We're holding on page Ayin Hey in Rosh Hashanah, the first paragraph that begins on the page, Shom Mas Nissin, middle of Ois Chof. The Mishnah describes that the Mishnah had said that we're still talking about Kiddush HaChodesh and informing everybody when Rosh Chodesh was. So the Mishnah says, Bori Shona Hayu Masi and Masois. Originally, they would light torches and have a relay of torches to tell everybody when Rosh Chodesh was. Meshakilkalu Akusim, when the Kusim started messing things up and lighting them on the war at the wrong times. Hiskinu Shiyu Shluchim Yotzim, and the Chacham made a takana that we're going to send out Shluchim, and that's when you started having the concept of 2 days of Yom Tov, because the Bnei Chutz La'aretz couldn't know when Rosh Chodesh had been declared in time for most of the Yom Tov. Yeah, but the difference. So actually, the Rambam Mefarshim will point out the Shluchim generally would carry a letter from the Sanhedrin that says that they're who they say they are. I mean, the Gemara actually mentions in general a Yid has a Cheskas Kashrus, so that if a Yid comes and says, based in declared Rosh Chodesh on such and such a day, we can believe him because it's Milsa David Aligluy. But yeah, in case the Kusim, the only way would be if they'd be able to forge a letter from the Beis Din, and I guess to that extent they weren't necessarily going to, yeah. So Ketzed Hoyu Masi and Masois, how did they do the system with the torches? Mevi'in Klon Sois Shel Erez Arukin. They would bring long poles made out of cedar wood, V'konim, and sticks. The point is, everything else that they have over here is meant to be very flammable. So V'konim, and V'konim is not really so much sticks, it's more like bamboo and other plants like that. V'atzei Shemen, and wood from oil trees. So it can mean wood from olive trees that, for example, which have stopped producing fruit, where then you're allowed to cut them down, or it can mean wood from trees like pine trees or other things, or balsam trees or whatever, that have natural oils in them. Or an odas shel pishtan, and combings of flax, which are the basically the leftovers of the stems that are mixed in with the flax. All of those are very flammable. The kodesh, you would tie it around the end of the stick with a rope. You would go up to the top of a mountain, and then light them on fire, light the whole bundle on fire, and then move it back and forth and up and down. That way, Tosfos brings from the Yerushalmi, why do in all directions like that, so people don't mistake it for a shooting star, for example. Sometimes you see shooting stars or comets going horizontally, sometimes vertically, but never both. So this way, people are going to be seeing it from a few miles away. The Gemara is going to tell us how far there was approximately between one mountain and the next. So they're going to see a light off in the distance. You don't want them to think it's something else. He'd continue waving in all directions until he sees that the next one on the top of the next mountain was doing the same thing. Meaning, obviously, before Rosh Chodesh, or and the night, as the night is beginning, people would go up to these respective mountains with their equipment, and then they'd do like that. If they saw the first one, then they'd do the second one, and so forth. And so on the third mountain, and they would continue like that until it reached all the way to Bava. And from where to where did they do these torches? The Mishnah mentions a chain of mountains beginning from Har HaMishcha, which is Har HaZeisim, right outside Yerushalayim, and continuing with several mountains until you reach the border between Eretz Yisrael and Bava. So besides, I mean, B'Pashtus, we have it over here in Ein Yaakov, just because we want to show how it's part of Agadah, how the Chachamim used to do that, how they wanted to inform the Jews out of town as fast as possible. There are various Chassidish Vertlach and whatever that deal with various details of deeper meanings of Masi and Masuris, of the torches. They have to do with Avodas HaTefillah, and that the chain of mountains, which he only brings the first line of a bit over here, with Chidah, has a whole explanation that those mountains symbolize the trajectory of a person, starting from the Baskol, the Yotzis Mehar Sinai, and then getting rid of his Yetzirah, and so on and so forth, and he explains the names of each of them in accordance with that. Okay. So now, the Mishnah had mentioned that you use Kloinsis Shel Erez, poles of cedar wood. So that leads the Gemara into a discussion. Now, we think of Erez as cedar, as a specific species of tree. But the Gemara explains there are actually several species that go under the name Erez. So first the Gemara lists four of them, then it brings based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, which lists seven different types of trees, and the Gemara understands them to all be subspecies of Erez, and then there are three more for a total of 10. Tosfos brings actually that there's a Yerushalmi that says even more, there are 24. So what makes them subspecies of Erez? Maybe because they're all hardwoods, maybe because they're all tall, stately trees, whatever it is, there's something that they have in common that makes them all able to be called under the general category of Erez. So one of those 10 that the Gemara mentions, so again, you have seven in a Pasuk in Yeshaya, and then you have three more that the Chachamim mention, of which one of those three, there's two different versions of what the other three were, but in both versions, the 10th one on the list is coral. Now, coral is not really a tree. It's made by little microscopic organisms that live in the oceans and then gather calcium and make it as a shell around themselves, and then eventually those little creatures die off and you have the corals left. But there's a type of coral that grows in that part of the world, in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea or whatever, that's red and branched and it looks very much like a tree. And in halacha, it's actually considered a tree. And as far as the halachas of Tumah V'Tahara, for example, usually we have a rule called Kol Abomine Yam Tohar, whatever grows in the sea is usually not Makabel Tumah, but coral, the Mishnayos and Masechta Kelim mention, is in fact, I think it says there it's not Makabel Tumah, so I may be wrong on that. Whatever, it's considered wood in halacha. It's mentioned in Masechta Melachim and Divrei Yomim. It mentions that Malchus Shiva brought some to Shlomo HaMelech. It calls it in one place Almugim and in the other place Algumim, whatever, even though scientifically it's not a tree, the Gemara considers it as such and considers it to be a species of Erez because of its shape. So now that leads the Gemara into a description of how they would harvest coral. It grows far underwater. How are they supposed to get any of it in the first place? So Ksiv, as a Pasuk says, the context of the Pasuk is talking about, you have a couple of the Nevi'im describe, and we learned about this in Yuma, a stream that La'osid Lava is going to start out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim and flow through the Azara and flow out through Yerushalayim and then out to the various bodies of water surrounding Eretz Yisrael and sweeten them and make them no longer salty. And so the Pasuk in Yeshaya describes some things about that stream, which eventually becomes a mighty river. He says, but see Adir lo yavrenu, even a mighty ship will not be able to cross that stream. Representing, in other words, that the Goyim will even if they take their strongest and biggest warships, they won't be able to cross it to come harm the Jewish people. So what's this Tzi Adir? Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Zubuni Gdoila. A Tzi Adir refers to what's called in their times a Buni Gdoila, a very large type of ship. So an extra large ship like that, which they would use for passengers or merchandise or war or whatever. Marsha points out also the word Adir usually signifies something strong, like Adir Bamorim Hashem. So what's particularly strong about this Buni? So now the Gemara is going to explain how they would use the tremendous strength of such a ship to harvest coral. Heichi Avdi, how would they do it? Maisin Shita Alfi Gavri Betresi Yarchi Shapa. They would have 6,000 workers working for 12 months of the year, or some say 12,000 people in 6 months. So I guess the pashtus, it depended how fast they wanted to harvest it and how much manpower was available. Anyway, umaisu svinta, they would bring a ship, one of these buni gdolas, one of these very large ships, the ton and lochala, and they would have all of these 6,000 or 12,000 workers throughout all that time would be filling up the ship with sand. Ad the shochna until the ship is so heavy that it sinks to the bottom. It sinks the bottom of it. The keel of it lands in the sand on the seabed. But the top of it, the deck of the ship is still above the water level. So you have all the sand was placed in there in order to weigh it down. So in other words, the point, this is why they need a davka buni gdola. Imagine, for example, the coral grows 50 feet underwater. Then you're going to need a ship where the deck of it is more than 50 feet above water, so that when it sinks to the bottom, the deck of it is still above the water level. Ben Yehoyada points out, by the way, it wasn't just they needed this many people in order to fill it up with sand. It's more the point. When you think about it, then we're talking about this coral, and there would be someplace offshore. It wouldn't be right next to the shore. So therefore, it's not just the fact that they have to have a lot of workers filling up the ship with sand. They have to have workers taking sand from the banks, from the shore, from the beaches, and rowing it over in smaller boats to there, and then dumping it in and going back and forth. And that's why it took so much manpower. Anyway, v'nochis bar amuroi, once you have the bottom of the ship is sitting on the seabed, then a diver would dive down, v'kotter atuni dekitna bekista. He would tie linen ropes to the kista, which is the Aramaic word for the coral. So he'd tie one end of a rope to the coral, and the other end, v'kotter lahu besfinta, and the other end of the rope he would tie to the bottom of the ship. Rashi says they would use linen ropes in particular because those are less likely to snap. Now the workers would come and start dumping out all the sand that they had put on the ship to weigh it down. So eventually the ship, as it got lighter and lighter, would start rising up in the water. And as it rises up, then it would pull, because the ropes now are tied to the coral below the water. Now when it comes up, it would pull out the coral with it. Point is, otherwise they had no way of getting it because the coral was too tightly attached to the seabed. But so like this, they had to use the energy of a big ship like that coming up from the seafloor in order to get it. The result was that the coral would fetch twice its weight in silver. So for any weight of coral that you would bring, you could get twice that weight in silver coins as payment for it. Which explains, for example, we find by Malchus Shva again, where it says that she brought coral to Shlomo. Based on this description, we see it was a very rare and valuable thing that she brought him. And the pasuk goes on to say, by the way, that Shlomo didn't just put it in his treasury or something. It says he used it for instruments in the Beis Hamikdash, for musical instruments in the Beis Hamikdash, and for a walkway to the Beis Hamikdash. So he used it for as much as possible to beautify the Beis Hamikdash. Anyway, it continues the Gemara. You see, by the way, this is an example. Some of the Mephoshim point out, this is an example of like Yuridat Tzor Chaliyah. You have this ship sinking to the bottom, but then when it comes up, then you have something twice as valuable as what you started with. Yeah. So the Gemara says, Tlas Parvosa Havyan. There was an area where they did this, where there were three ports near each other. Taute Bei Remoi v'choda Bei Parsoi. Two of them were in Roman territory, and one of them was in Persian territory. This is, we're talking in the Persian Gulf, or in that area. So you had areas near there that the Romans ruled over and controlled two of these ports, and near there you had the Persian Empire, which at that time ruled over Babel and Persia and various other countries to the east of that, and they had one port in that area. So the two ports that belonged to the Romans, they would use this whole method with the Bruni Gdola and harvest coral from there. The Persians would use their port that they had in that area to dive for pearls. They would pearls you can also find on the seabed. So they would use their ports for that. They called their port the royal port because they harvested pearls over there, which are a royal kind of thing. Ben Yehoyada points out that the Ben Yehoyada the Ben Ishchai lived in Iraq, which is in that same general part of the world. He identifies Parvosa the Mashmehig. He says maybe the place that's now called Bahrain, where in fact Adayem Azeh, they have pearl fisheries over there. He doesn't identify what the two ports would be where they collected coral. Maybe he wasn't familiar with them. Besides, for the simple meaning of the story, the Maharal talks about various details of symbolism in this whole description. One point he makes is because the coral that we're talking about is red, therefore Edom, the Romans, have more of an affinity for it. Therefore they collect coral, whereas the Persians don't have an affinity for that kind of thing, so they collect their pearls. And he points out also the Romans, B'chlal, we find, are generally stronger than the Persians. We have at the beginning of Masechta Avodah Zarah, it mentions, for example, when there comes the point when Hashem judges, when Hashem calls in all the nations one after the other for judgment, and the Romans come and are judged first because they're the greatest power. So therefore, they have two ports to only the one that the Persians have. Okay, the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, here's a drasha based on that pasuk. So again, earlier the Gemara had brought a pasuk which is not here in Ein Yaakov. That went and explained on that pasuk mentioned seven different types of trees, and the Gemara had said those represent seven different species that are called erez. So now the Gemara brings up drasha on that pasuk. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kol shita v'shita shenotlu over the kachavim Yerushalayim, every single shita tree that the goyim took away from Yerushalayim when they destroyed it, osid HaKadosh Baruch Hu lachzirun lo, Hashem is going to return those trees to Yerushalayim la'asid lover, to rebuild it. The pasuk mentions Hashem says, I will place in the desert the cedar and shita and hadas trees and eitz shemen, which are another, the oil-soaked trees that we mentioned in the Mishnah. What's midbar? In midbar, El Yerushalayim, Shenemet Siyan midbar ha-yosa, Yerushalayim Shemama, we find another pasuk where, which talks about after the Churban, how Yerushalayim is a desert. So we see that the Yerushalayim is, so therefore the midbar that Hashem says, where I'm going to put all these trees, is referring to Yerushalayim. So we're saying that all these trees, which were there in Yerushalayim for building materials before, and the Goyim destroyed it and robbed the Yidden of it, now Hashem is going to bring it all back. The point is, Maharsha says, the point behind the Drasha is that if it was just a matter that Hashem is going to plant these trees over there, then what's the etain? It should say eta, I will plant. So therefore what it means is etain, that I'm going to transplant them from there, I'm going to bring them to there to rebuild the ruins of Yerushalayim. So that brings us now to the fact that Goyim ruined and destroyed Yerushalayim, and now Hashem is going to bring that back. Why does he mention the shita specifically? So Maharsha points out, we often find shittim wood is used specifically for building. We find it was used to build the Mishkan, for example. So therefore, that's why Rabbi Yochanan's Zerusha focuses on the shita, even though the pasuk is mentioning other types of trees as well. There are also Verut Lachanet that shita also refers to shittis in learning and shittis in seeing the world and Avodas Hashem and so forth. And it means also that the Goyim took all of that away from us and we lost so much of it in Golos, and then the Asid Lava Hashem is going to restore all of that. Rabbi Yechanan says, here's another Jerusha that we get from this pasuk. We're saying that one of the things Hashem is going to place in the Midbar is a Hadas tree. So kol ha-loymed Torah v'enim alamda, if a person learns Torah for himself, but he doesn't teach it to others, then he's like a hadas tree in the desert. There's nobody to benefit from it. The hadas we know represents the one who learns Torah. Actually, Maharsha mentions that, although usually we say when it comes to the Dalad Minim, we usually say the Lulav is the one who learns Torah. The hadas is usually the Baal Maisim Tovim, but he brings from the Drashim and Piyotim that the fragrance of the hadas refers to the Baalei Torah. So then if he doesn't give out that fragrance to somebody else, then it's like a hadas that has a beautiful fragrance, but it's in the desert over there and there's nobody to benefit. Another version is the other way around. When a person learns Torah and teaches it in a place where there's no Talmud Chachamim, then he's like a hadas in the desert, just the opposite, where everybody finds such a thing precious. Anybody who comes by will take some of that hadas to enjoy the fragrance. So the same way, in other words, when there are a lot of hadasim around, you might not appreciate one particular one, but this is the solitary hadas over there in the desert, then everybody appreciates it all the more. That's like the Talmud Chacham who's there and teaches Torah without anybody else to, when there's nobody else around who's teaching along with it. V'amar Rabbi Yechanan. Rabbi Yechanan says another drasha, since we mentioned about the Goyim that Hashem is going to restore everything that was stolen and robbed from Yerushalayim. So V'amar Rabbi Yechanan, Oy lahem la'ovd kachavim, she'en lahem takona. Woe to the Goyim, they have no takona as far as what they robbed from us. Shenema, you have another pasuk, also in Yeshaya, Hashem says, tachas and achoshes, in place of the copper that was taken from the Jewish people, avi zahav, Hashem says, I'll bring gold instead. V'sachas ha-barizol avi chesef, instead of the iron that was taken away, I'll bring silver. V'sachas ha-etzim nechoshes, instead of the wood, each thing is going to be replaced by something more valuable. So instead of the wood, there's going to be copper, we're going here. V'sachas ha-avonim barizol, it goes on to say, instead of stones, there's going to be iron. So everything that was stolen and robbed from the Jewish people and from Yerushalayim specifically, Hashem is going to bring back, meaning that Hashem is going to make the goyim pay back with something more valuable than what they took. But the most valuable thing they took, Tachas Rabbi Akiva b'Chaveira, Mayim Mevi'in. They took from us and they robbed us of Rabbi Akiva b'Chaveira, the Asor Arugim Malchus. What can they bring to, instead of that? What greater thing is there that, what greater and more valuable thing is that, can they bring than that? They can't. So therefore, va'aleim nemar, that's what the pasuk means when it says, v'nikesi, Hashem says, even if I'm willing to clean up all of their averus, domam lo nikesi, Hashem says, their blood, the blood of Rabbi Akiva v'chaveira, of another tzaddikim that they spilled, that I will not clean up, because they have no way of bringing anything more valuable than it. Hashem shochen b'tzion, and the pasuk finishes off, Hashem dwells in Tzion, meaning from there he's going to judge and punish the goyim for what they did. On the face of it, we're just saying about Kiva v'chaverav, but actually, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz points out in a Sefer Yaris Dvash, he says, you know, when you get down to it, even the most poshut yid has it in him, has the capability within him to any time do tshuva and become a great tzaddik. So imagine, he says, you have a poshut yid, even a Baal Averis or whatever was killed by goyim. Nevertheless, Hashem is going to say that person would have had the opportunity to do tshuva and become a great tzaddik, and you deprive them of that. Therefore, Hashem is going to hold the goyim responsible for that as well. That we can apply that now to all the kedushim who were killed on Simchas Torah, and all the ones during the Holocaust, and the various other ones like that. What Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz is saying flat out is, don't think as some people do. You know, they weren't frum anyway. Who cares? No, he's saying that Hashem is going to hold the goyim responsible and get them for every single one. What? Yeah, the song of any case comes from this pasuk, yeah. Vinny Casey Domum, that's true, right? Yeah. It's true. It's really Vinny Casey Domum Loini Casey. It's true, yeah. It's hardly the only pasuk that people misparse, but yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. Piska, quoting from the Mishnah, so the Mishnah had listed the various places where they would stand on one mountain and wave their torches until they saw it on the next mountain and so forth. The last place that the Mishnah mentions is called Beis Biltin. So my Beis Biltin, what is that place? This is a place that in their times, in the time of the Amoraim, was called Biram. We find in other Gemaras, it was a border city on the border between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. The Gemara mentions it in Kiddushin. There's a long sugya over there about what's considered Bavel as far as the dinim of Yuchsin, where we assume that the Jews of Bavel in general are Miuchosim, and the ones of Eretz Yisrael less so. So the Gemara mentions over there that the Miuchosim of Pumbedissa would regularly marry wives from Biram. So we see that Biram is a place which is also known to have good yuchsin. Tosfos, in fact, learns over there it is actually part of Eretz Yisrael, but nevertheless close enough to Bavel that it had the same rules. Okay, then the Mishnah had said. So the Mishnah had said that the guy in Beis Biltin. So there's no next mountain after that. He's already on the edge of Bavel, and Bavel is a low lying area. There's no mountains in it. So what would he do? So the Mishnah describes he would stand there waving his torch until he saw the whole goyla in front of him, kimeduras esh, like a bonfire. So my goyla, what does goyla mean? It can't mean Bavel as a whole. You wouldn't be able to see the entire country of Bavel from Beis Biltin. Specifically, it means that he would see the city of Pumbedissa, which, as we just said, is not far from Biram, and people would regularly make shidduchim between families in Pumbedissa and families in Biram. So from there, he would see the city of Pumbedissa, and then what happened was, what do we mean? It would look like a bonfire. Once the people in Pumbedissa saw him waving his torch from Beis Biltin, each person would take a torch in his hand and go up to the roof of his house and wave it in order to show him that yes, his message has been received, and we in Bavel now know that tonight and tomorrow is a Shodesh. Actually, strictly speaking, what it is, as the Gemara explains, they would do the torches on the night after Rosh Chodesh. The Gemara explains there's reasons why they couldn't do it the night before because of certain kinds of confusion that would come up. Whatever, we know now when Rosh Chodesh was, and now we know when the Yom Tovim would be. And then from there, they would disseminate the news to the rest of the Jews in Bavel. It comes out actually based on Igeres Reb Shuda Goin and based on other sources that really originally, first of all, the reason why the Gemara is calling Pumbedissa Goyla is because of the center of Jewish life in Bavel in those days. Like if you talk about the United States and you talk about New York, you can use New York almost as a proxy for the entire Jewish community in the United States. In the same sense, they would use Pumbedissa as a proxy for the entire Bavel. But actually, we find in various places that originally Nahavdah held that role. For example, when Shmuel set up his yeshiva, he set it up in Nahavdah. What it is Reb Shuda Goin mentions in his famous letter on Jewish history, his famous Igeres Reb Shuda Goin, he mentions there came a point when there was a warlord named Papa Bar Netzer. He's mentioned a couple of places in Shas, who came and his army invaded Bavel and destroyed the city of Nahavdah. So then it was rebuilt and resettled, but in the meantime, the center of Jewish life in Bavel moved to Pumbedissa. So now Rabbi Yosef is talking in terms of his own times, where Pumbedissa has become the new center in the time when the Mishnah was written, it would have actually been the Haudah. Okay. Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Rav Shimon Elazar Omer, that the Rav Shimon Elazar says it's not only the mountains that were listed in our Mishnah, Achorim, Bekir, Vegeder, Vechavre Seha, also Chorim, Kir, and Geder, and other neighboring mountains were also used for these signals. There are different Yusoris, actually. Agros, Agro, and the Gemara points out that the first two, at least, is supposed to really be Chore Michvar, which refers to the mountains of Michvar, which is an area in Eivor Ayad. The Targum, you have mentioned in Eivor Ayad, you have a place called Yazer that's mentioned in the territory of Bnei God, and the Targum translates it as Michvar. Anyway, so sort of Shimon Elazar says they would also light torches on those mountains. Ika da'ami beni ubeni havukaimi. Some say that Shimon Elazar is mentioning mountains between the other ones. In other words, the Mishnah mentions, for example, the first one is Hara Mishcha, which is outside Yerushalayim. The second one is Sautava, which is up in the Shomron, which is a long way from Yerushalayim. So in between, there would be other mountains where they would be, where they'd have signals as well, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to see that far. Others say that the mountains of Shimon Elazar is listing were on the other side of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, there were two possible routes that you could take to get from Yerushalayim to Bavel. So our Mishnah lists one of them, and Rav Shimon Elazar is listing some of the key points on the other one. So Mar Choshev, the High Giso, according to that, then the Tana of our Mishnah is listing one chain of mountains going in one direction, and Rav Shimon Elazar is listing a chain going in a different direction. No, so what it would be is like this. In other words, the Gemara explains that they would do it only when there was a Chodesh Mole, not when there was a Chodesh Chaser, when Edom did not come on the 30th day to say that that day had been Rosh Chodesh, and they would light the torches that night to tell everybody that tonight and tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh, and today was Lamed, and tomorrow was Aleph. And the Gemara goes into why they did it that way. Why couldn't they do it for a Chodesh Chaser? Because there are problems with what happens if it comes out on Shabbos, and the Gemara goes through a number of possibilities over there. Anyway, so the point would be, when they had, so it would be like this, every month, since obviously places far away from Yerushalayim don't know whether Beis Din is going to declare that a Chodesh Mole or not, so they would go up to their respective mountains on them. So they would know. They know already from the previous month. Today is Chof Ches. Today is Chof Tes. Today might be Lamed, or it might be Aleph of the next month. We don't know yet. So they would go up to their respective mountains on what might be Lamed of the previous month with their equipment for their torches. And then if they saw the signal from Hara Mishcha, then the guy on Sautava would light his and start waving it and so on and so forth. And the message would get out that way. So the way it worked, so officially the way it worked then was you always had one day Rosh Chodesh. It was either Rosh Chodesh would either be the 30th or the 1st. That we keep 2 days Rosh Chodesh is really, it's sort of Sveika D'Yoma, although not exactly, because in Eretz Yisrael they're not Sveika D'Yoma, but it's still, the idea is it could have been Rosh Chodesh, and especially we're saying once they, especially sometimes it could happen, for example, that sometimes Beis Din didn't know, well, was the moon visible last night or was it not? They would do all the calculations to see it could have been visible, but on the other hand, it could have been cloudy or Adam might not have been able to get there or whatever. So people would keep the 30th as Rosh Chodesh just in case. And then if Adam hadn't come all that day, then they know the next day is Rosh Chodesh. So we nowadays keep both days as Rosh Chodesh because they would keep the first one as. So when did that start? 2 days? Maybe when they made the Luach Kavur, or maybe before it. I'm not sure about that. Rosh Hashanah, we know, is related to that also. Later on in the Masechta, it talks about that one time the Edom didn't come in time on Rosh Hashanah day, and the Skalkul Alavim Bashir, there was a whole mix-up about what Shir Shol Yom they should sing, the one for a regular weekday or the one for Rosh Hashanah, and after that, Chachamim made a takana that you're only accepting Edom until Mincha time. And then if they don't come by then, then they would have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. So actually, so that the Gemara is mentioning that about Rosh Hashanah, but the truth is that may have applied to Rosh Chodesh as well. So maybe from the time of that Takana and on is when they had the concept of 2 days of Rosh Chodesh. We do actually find, now that you mention it, we do find earlier where it seems that sometimes they had 2 days Rosh Chodesh as well. You have Vayom Elo Yohanesan Mocha Chodesh. And yes, so the next day is Rosh Chodesh. And then you have the day after that, Vayom HaChodesh HaSheni, that also David is missing, and Shoal asks what's going on, and the whole thing blows up over there. So we see that there was an example in Shoal's time where they attacked had 2 days Rosh Chodesh. So they'd still light the fires only on the second night. the vote would be. In other words, that may have been one of those times when Yonason is telling David Mocha Chodesh, because he knows, for example, he being a member of the Sanhedrin, the Gemara mentions he was actually the Av Beis Din. So he would know that the moon is expected to be visible tonight, and therefore it's likely that Edom will come tomorrow. In the event, maybe no Edom showed up for whatever reason, and therefore they had to have a second day of Rosh Chodesh. So then in that case, when would they light the torches, would be the night after the first day of Rosh Chodesh. Now, that's the Gemara says, the general rule, they would light the torches. They wouldn't light the torches when there was a Chodesh Chaser, only when there was a Chodesh Molly. The Gemara continues, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bein kol achas v'achas shmoina parsois. Between each mountain and the next one, the main mountains, that is, that it mentions in our Mishnah, shmoina parsois, there's eight parsa between one and the next. The parsa is around 2.5 or 3 miles, so eight parsa is somewhere around 20 or 25 miles. That would be the pashtus, that would be the limit of vision. Any far away, any further away than that, you're not really going to see a torch wave, even if it's waving. So the Gemara asks, Kama Havi Lahu? Well, then how does it come? How much does it come out? The Mishnah mentions five stations, with Hara Mishcha outside Yerushalayim being the first, and base built in by the edge of Bavel being the last. So Kama Havi Lahu? How much do you have then? Tlosin v'tartin. It comes out. You're implying, Rabbi Yochanan, that there's only 32 parsa between Yerushalayim and the edge of Bavel. The question is, and nowadays it's a much longer trip from Yerushalayim to get to the edge of Eretz Yisrael. 32 parsa, again, with parsa being 2.5 to 3 miles, you're talking about something like 80 to 100 miles or so. It's a lot further than that. The answer is the original clear roads have been closed up. Originally, yes, there were more direct roads to get from one place to another, and therefore, yes, it would be a shorter trip. Nowadays, the roads have been closed up. It can be because, Shenev Dichtiv, as the Pasuk says, Lochain, Hashem says, therefore, because of the Avedus of the Jewish people, Hinni Sochas Darkech Basirim, I'm going to hedge in your roads with thorns. So it can mean actual thorns. It can mean, for example, that the old straight roads ended up getting abandoned because of danger or whatever, and now they have to get in there, and then eventually they got overgrown with thorns and weeds, and therefore you can't travel on them anymore, and therefore they have to take detours. Or it can mean that you have, for example, you have Romans patrolling the roads and preventing people from going the direct ways, and therefore they have to go in roundabout ways. Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar Mehachar. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says you have another pasuk that expresses this idea. Dichtiv, you have in Eicha Nisivoisai Iva. The Navi says Hashem has made my paths crooked. So the same idea. In other words, originally they had very straight paths, very direct routes to get from one place to another, and now they don't have that. There are a couple of examples of that Chazal mentioned in other places. There's a Yerushalmi that mentions a story where there was a Yid in some place in the south of Eretz Yisrael where his cow ran away, and he ran after it, and he winds up by the edge of Bavel after only about an hour or so. So also implying that the distances were much shorter at the time. A little hard to understand, because when you look on a map, the fact is, you see, even as the crow flies, it's a lot further than that, but that's how the Yerushalmi tells the story. Another example, Medrash mentions on Eicha, in connection with the Spasik, Nisivoisei Iva, I think it mentions that, for example, you could have, back in the day, a woman living in Lud could put up a batch of dough, rush off to the Bes Mikdash to daven, and come back, and the dough wouldn't be chametz yet. So here the same thing. The Gemara is saying that, in other words, they used to have much more direct routes. Okay, so the Mishnah goes on to talk about how Beis Din would interrogate the Edim, and among the questions they would ask the Edim is, Lifnei Achama or La'achar Achama, did you see the moon behind the sun or in front of the sun? So the Gemara explains that Lifnei Achama would, and the Mishnah goes on to say that if he said Lifnei Achama, like Omar Klum, so the Gemara asks at first, what does Lifnei Achama mean exactly? And then Omar Abaye, Pgimosa Lifnei Achama, or La'achar Achama. It means they would ask the aid, did you see the concave side, the missing side of the moon? The moon is a crescent at the beginning of the month. So the inner side of the crescent, did you see it towards the sun or away from the sun? And therefore, the Mishnah says, so if he says he saw that concave side pointing to the sun, then what he said is worthless, because the lit side of the moon is always going to be facing the sun. You have, by the way, they mention in that connection, you can think of the English word dock to think of how you see the moon throughout the month. The beginning of the month, you see the crescent in this direction, looking like the bow of a letter D. In the middle, it's full, like an O, and at the end of the month, you see it facing in this direction like a C, because at the beginning of the month, it's setting after the sun, Therefore, you have the sun is set, and you still see the moon visible, or you still see the moon visible in the sky. And therefore, yeah, the lit side of it is facing towards the sun, facing towards the right. And then at the end of the month, it's the other way around. It's setting earlier than the sun. Therefore, you see the lit side of it facing in the other direction. So here we're talking at the beginning of the month. So if the guy says lifnei achama, then what he said doesn't count for anything. Then it means he didn't see the moon. It means he's lying, or it means what he saw was not the moon, but a patch of cloud that he thought was the moon, or whatever. What does the pasuk mean? It says that dominion, rulership, and fear is with him. Is in other words, in Shemayim, the Hashem rules over everything, and they all fear him. Oysa shalom bimroim, Hashem makes peace in his heights. So what does that mean? How does Hashem make peace in his heights in Shemayim? It means the sun never faces the dark side of the moon or the inside of the rainbow. A rainbow is also it's refraction from the sun, but it's always such that the outside of the bow always faces towards the sun, and the inside of it faces towards the ground. So why is that? The sun never faces towards the concave side of the moon, because it would make the moon feel bad. As it is, we have the moon was originally the same size as the sun, and then Eibishter told it, so to have to face the sun and would make it feel even worse. They don't have, well, the Rambam actually says they do. We just learned we restarted Rambam Shlosha Prakim, and the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah that the stars and planets do have a das. They do. They have a das, and they're mahalal and shabayach the Eibishter. So yeah. What about? They have more das than we do. That's true, right? Yeah. And the Masa Shokeshes, and why does the sun face away? Why does the inside of the rainbow face away from the sun? You don't want goyim who worship the sun to think that when you see a rainbow, it means the sun is shooting arrows at those who don't want to worship it. When you shoot a bow, the concave side, the inside of the curve of the bow, is always facing you, and the curve faces away from you. So like this, Hashem Davka makes that the curve is facing towards the sun rather than away from it. So Maharsha explains, this is the Hamshel v'fachad imoy, that this way, actually, everybody should realize, they shouldn't think the sun has any memshala of its own. No, Hashem has the exclusive memshala. So then, therefore, that's why Hashem made it in that way. There are some approaches, by the way, we talk about that it also represents that also using this metaphor of using a bow to shoot, that the why is the rainbow a sign that Hashem is not going to bring a marble? There's the idea, Foshim explained, that again, when you're shooting a bow, you have the bow turned away from you. So if the rainbow appeared upside down, then it would be that, so to speak, Hashem is ready to start shooting arrows at the world. So instead, it's reversed to show, like Hashem is saying, I'm putting away my bow, I'm not going to harm the world. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Chof Gimel Adar Beis. Our generation has the responsibility to finish up the Birurim of Ikvas HaDi Mashiach and to bring down the revelation, the Gilui of Mashiach, the Matam Asarat Tfachim, into this physical world. So when a person thinks for even a little amount of time on these kinds of things, he should be fearing and trembling and realize, look at that, all of these amazing, tremendous things that Chazal talk about regarding Mashiach and all the Giluyim that are going to be then, all of that depends on our avodah. Continuing on Hilchos Shabbos. So we talked about dinim as far as getting cloths wet on Shabbos, what you're allowed and not allowed to do in terms of that you shouldn't come to do schita, wringing them out. So now a similar kind of thing. If you're walking in the street and you get wet from the rain. So then when you're still allowed to wear the wet clothes in the street. We're not concerned that you may squeeze them out in the street. So you go home, but when you change out of them, you can't spread them out to dry, even if it's not wet from rain, even if it's only wet from sweat, then you're not allowed to, because that would make it look, it would be marasayin, it would make it look like you washed them on Shabbos. And by the way, the Gemara says you have the rule that whenever something is also because of marasayin, it's also even b'chadrei chadorim, even if you do it in a private room where nobody can see you. You certainly are not allowed to spread them out near a fire or a heater or something to dry, because then you have the problem of mevashel, of cooking the water in them. In fact, that would apply even if you're still wearing the clothing, because again, if you stand close enough to the heater that now the beged can become yad seledus boy, then you have a problem that now you're cooking the water in there. You're also not allowed to shake out the water from it on Shabbos. When you have a beged that you machbit on that it shouldn't be wet, and that applies to most of our clothes nowadays, then b'chlal, once you take it off, you're not even allowed to handle it because you may squeeze it out. Although the Alter Rebbe then says on that, if it's only a little bit wet and it's not the kind of thing you'd really be machbit on, then you are allowed to handle it, then it's not mukta. But if it's soaking, then not. Okay.